This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we have two guests that confront the role of religion in American politics today. We begin with Andrew Seidel, Vice President for Communications at Americans United for Separation of Church and State, to alert us to the threat that white Christian nationalism poses to separation of church and state in America. Then we'll be joined by Jamie Barron, CEO of Bend the Ark, to learn how progressive Jews and progressive Jewish organizations are grappling with the U.S. implications of the war in Gaza.
Stay with us.
I'm Stephen Rohde, retired civil rights lawyer and author on issues of civil liberties. The separation between church and state is a key component of our democracy, ensuring that freedom of belief is a right for all, not a privilege of some. The First Amendment's Establishment Clause, quote, "Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion," unquote, has been understood to prohibit the government from establishing an official religion or favoring one religion over others. This interpretation aims to ensure that the government remains neutral in religious matters and does not interfere with or support religious activities, thus maintaining a clear separation between religious institutions and government functions. Despite this, recent rulings of the right-leaning Supreme Court blur the lines between church and state and threaten to undermine this important doctrine. The rise of white Christian nationalism contributes to the degradation of the principle of separation of church and state. This movement reflects broader cultural and demographic trends and exerts significant influence on policy, public discourse, and grassroots movements. Addressing this issue involves understanding the underlying causes and promoting policies that uphold the constitutional commitment to religious neutrality and freedom. Joining us today, I'm so pleased to be discussing white Christian nationalism and its impact, is attorney Andrew Seidel, one of the nation's leading authorities on this issue. Andrew is Vice President for Communications at Americans United for Separation of Church and State, an organization I've long admired and supported. And that's an organization that challenges threats to freedom of religion and the First Amendment. Andrew is also the author of two acclaimed books, The Founding Myth, Why Christian Nationalism is Un-American. That's a book I reviewed for the Los Angeles Review of Books in 2019, calling it brilliant, ambitious, well-researched, and compelling. And Andrew has followed it up now with American Crusade, How the Supreme Court is Weaponizing Religious Freedom. Andrew, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Well, thank you so much for having me and for that very generous introduction. It's a pleasure to be with you.
In that 2019 book, The Founding Myth, you unpack the myth held by white Christian nationalists that our nation was founded on Judeo-Christian principles. Why do you claim that white Christian nationalism is un-American?
If you look at that wall of separation between church and state that you explained so well in your introduction, that is an American original. That's an American invention. The idea for that was floating around during the Enlightenment, but it was first implemented in the American experiment. Until then, no other nation in the history of the world had sought to protect the ability of its citizens to think freely by separating religion and government. And I think that is something that we can and should be proud of. And we certainly shouldn't let people undermine it with myths about a Christian nation. And if we want to dig a little deeper and go into the next layer, right? Like, most of the truly unique and original elements of our Constitution are secular, right? Our Constitution was the first to declare that power comes from people, not gods. So the words "we the people" are poetic, but they're so much more. They are a declaration of power. Our Constitution was the first governing document not to mention a god or a deity. And it's godless by choice, not by accident. And there were people in the founding generation who objected to that choice. And our Constitution was the first to ban religious tests for public office. That's in Article 6. And that was actually the only mention of religion in the original unamended document. And it does this with some of the most clear and emphatic language in a document that's often deliberately vague. It says, "No religious test shall ever be required as a qualification to any office or public trust." No, shall, ever, any. These are strong, clear, emphatic words in a document that we know was drafted at times to be intentionally vague. And then, after all of that, you have the First Amendment, which clearly separates church and state and guarantees religious freedom in the process. So this separation is woven throughout our Constitution. It's not just in the First Amendment. And sure, there's a whole lot that's wrong with our Constitution, but those secular foundations are what made it unique, and they are genuine contributions, not only to political science and thought, but to all humanity. And as you said in the introduction, those contributions are threatened, they're undermined, and they are under attack by white Christian nationalism.
Well, let's turn to that in detail. What are the broader cultural and demographic trends at play in white Christian nationalism?
That's a really good question. So the first thing I'm going to do is define that for some people who may not be as familiar with what white Christian nationalism is. And this, you know, depending on who you ask, you know, you'll get a different definition from sociologists than you will from journalists, than you will from Christians. My perspective is, you know, I have been more on the side of fighting Christian nationalism, doing battle in courts and in the court of public opinion. But there are a few useful elements that everybody kind of agrees on. And the first is this idea of the Christian nation, which is what gives the ideology its name. And that idea of America being founded as a Christian nation and based on Judeo-Christian or Christian principles is integral to this identity. And the second aspect is that we have strayed from that founding, right? So they use the language of return, of getting back to a golden age, getting back to our godly roots, to the way America was, to justify a lot of their unpopular and even hateful public policy. And the third part that I think is really important is that this ideology is a permission structure. And that's because it is based in religious beliefs and identity. Christian nationalism, it does not mean all Christians. There are plenty of Christians who are fighting Christian nationalism who are not Christian nationalists. But the religion is integral to the identity because they believe that this is their country given to them by their God. So that anything that goes against that is against the will of their God. And that is what gives them permission to subjugate their innate humanity and empathy and pursuit of power. So, I mean, those are kind of like important elements. But to your bigger question of why, right? Why are we seeing conservative white Christian Americans turning to Christian nationalism? It's because their status as the dominant group in our society is threatened, and it has been for some time. They are losing the culture wars, which I think is a little bit of a silly phrase that often masks attacks on human rights. The simple fact is that their ideas are unpopular. They're losing the power and the privilege and the deference they believe that they are due. And the reason why they're losing that is because every day we are coming closer to racial and gender and LGBTQ equality, and because they're kind of used to seeing this narrow world which reflects only themselves, only their straight, white, conservative Christian patriarchy, so that the existence, let alone the equality of other people, feels like a threat to them. And there's some really good social data on this that shows that when a dominant group or a caste in a society feels threatened or left behind by circumstances, that it overreacts by seeking ways to retain that status. And that's really why they're turning to Christian nationalism and to turning to violent insurrection and tearing down our democratic norms in these so-called strongmen. And that's why they're working to weaponize religious freedom. I mean, the short version is that as we realize the aspirational values that are implicit in we the people and equal justice under law and these other founding maxims, as we recognize that humans are human and worthy of rights, conservative white Christian America is dying this slow demographic death and rebelling. And they are raging against the dying of their privilege. And so they declared war. And Christian nationalism is that declaration of war.
Is this part of the replacement theory borrowed from some European theorists?
That plays into it, certainly. And in fact, there's I go over some studies in American Crusade that show that Christian nationalists conflate demographic loss with a threat to their religious freedom. And that's worth repeating. So studies show that they conflate demographic loss, so the changes in demographics and the fact that white Christians are not going to be the majority or are losing their majoritarian status, with a threat to their religious freedom. Which tells us a couple things. One, it tells us why the replacement theory is effective when it comes to fear-mongering. But it also tells us that they fundamentally misunderstand religious liberty as privilege. So these deeply conservative Christians who are accustomed to deference and privilege feel that these expansions of freedoms and the changing demographics violate their rights. And actually, sadly, a Supreme Court justice gave us a very good example of this. If you want to see this on display, go look up Samuel Alito's speech in Rome in the summer of 2022. So this is just a few weeks after he published the opinion that overturned Roe versus Wade. He gives this speech before this group in Rome, hosted by kind of this Christian nationalist outfit. It is full of grievance and the loss of privilege. And it's a really good example of this kind of this waning deference and that motivating a lot of the power grabs and the push for Christian nationalism that we're seeing.
Yes, it was no surprise that the tiki torch carrying men in Charlottesville yelled, "You will not replace us. Jews will not replace us." Let me ask you about the trends. How do these trends exert influence on policy, public discourse, and grassroots movements I spoke about in the introduction?
So it's important to understand that Christian nationalists are not just wrong about what America is and how it was founded. Their beliefs and identity run counter to the ideals on which this nation was founded. That's one of the reasons I say that it's un-American in the subtitle of my first book. And if you look at their policy preferences, their views, I hinted at this before, but they're wildly unpopular. So Christian nationalists generally oppose marriage equality, but something like 71% of Americans support it. They want to outlaw abortion, but something like 85% of Americans think it should be legal in some or most circumstances. They want a nation of Christians like them. 73% of Americans are more welcoming of religious pluralism. They'd almost certainly like to ban contraception too, but that's something that like 91% of Americans favor. So those numbers terrify them. Those numbers scare them, that the fact that the nuns, N-O-N-E-S, are on the rise because Americans are leaving religion behind, because we elected our first black president, because we have a black female vice president, because of marriage equality, because again, every day we're closer to racial and gender and LGBTQ equality, right? And all of those things are markers for them of their waning status or their lost status as the dominant group. And so much of what we're seeing comes back to that why. They are losing that status and they are desperately trying to hold on to power so that they can retain it, to capture institutions that would allow them to retain it, like the Supreme Court, for instance. And that really explains so much of what we are seeing right now. I genuinely do not think you can understand what is happening in American society or politics right now without understanding the influence of white Christian nationalism.
You've mentioned Justice Alito, the Supreme Court. In your 2022 book, American Crusade, you describe how the Supreme Court's using freedom of religion to push a religious agenda. Catch us up on recent Supreme Court cases for our listeners.
Yeah, so this is the crusade that we are talking about. And, you know, one of the things that I try to point out in American Crusade is that I think a lot of the confusion, is the word I will use right now, around religious freedom is misplaced. I actually do not think that the questions that have come to the court surrounding religious freedom are that difficult. I actually think they are pretty easy to solve if you get back to basics, if you cut through a lot of the BS that we lawyers and judges tend to build up around our profession, the jargon, the case names, even the legal tests. And this is what I try to do in American Crusade. And I think when you cut through a lot of that prattle and piffle, there's a simple truth that becomes fairly obvious. And that is that the questions presented when religion and the law collide are not all that hard to resolve. I lay out kind of three lines that you can synthesize from all of this case law and draw, can answer those three or obey those three lines. It answers almost all of the questions that come up around religious freedom. But to get to your question, we have seen a very sharp turn in the court over the last decade or so. And that is the crusade that I catalog in the book. So, you know, I really pinpoint this to a case in 2010 involving a cross in the Mojave Desert. That's really where I think the push to warp the legal definition of religious freedom kind of gets going. The Crusaders, who I identify as the legal groups that are kind of make up this billion-dollar shadow network. It's groups like Alliance Defending Freedom and the American Center for Law and Justice and Beckett Fund for Religious Liberty and Liberty Council and First Liberty Institute, this Orwellian word salad, right? They heard the message in that 2010 case and the floodgates opened. And they filed lawsuit after lawsuit. They stoked that fear of status loss, and they were able to raise millions and millions of dollars. And so the Crusaders set these cases up, and then the conservative justices come and knock them down. And that accelerates once Trump takes over and puts on his three justices. And so, you know, the first kind of substantive case is really 2011, when the court allows a voucher program to send taxpayer funds to religious schools by denying citizens the ability to challenge that program. That was 5-4. In 2012, it says that religious organizations can legally discriminate when hiring clergy, and then weaponizes that against employees who have no religious duties, claiming religious freedom. In 2014, it said that religious freedom can override the rights of other citizens. You know, it's in the Hobby Lobby opinion. And then upheld the Christian-only prayers at the town of Greece that the town of Greece had been imposing on its citizens. And then in 2017, you see a really remarkable change. The court actually forced taxpayers to fund a Lutheran children's ministry and church in the name of religious freedom. And this really crossed a line, and I think also shows why originalism is a little bit of a fake legal philosophy, is the kind way I will say that. And then in 2018, the court rediscovers this really potent argument that it's been using, hostility towards religion. And it used that hostility to let a business owner violate state civil rights laws and then discriminate against protected classes of people. And that same year, after bemoaning hostility toward Christians in that case, it actually upheld Donald Trump's Muslim ban. So you get really quickly to this version of religious freedom that really only applies to Christians, that religious freedom is not for non-Christians. In 2019, you have the court deciding that a massive Christian cross on government property paid to be upkept with government funds doesn't violate the separation of church and state. In 2020, it says that taxpayers must fund religious schools, another betrayal of America's founding principles. And then late that year and into the next is when it begins striking down public health measures in the name of religious freedom. And I mean, now we are in the Trump justice era and things are just accelerating. So in 2021, using this phalanx of legalism and jargon, the court unanimously held that a charity run by a Catholic church can discriminate against a minority in the name of God while performing government functions with taxpayer funds. And then in 2022, it forced the city of Boston to fly the Christian flag over City Hall, which is the same flag that the insurrectionists carried onto the floor of the Senate on January 6th. It abolished reproductive freedom. It forced taxpayers to fund religious indoctrination at bigoted Christian schools. And it allowed a coach in a public school to impose his personal religion on other people's kids. So, and there are other cases after that too, the 303 Creative case that allowed for-profit businesses to violate the civil rights of LGBTQ people. It's just getting worse and worse and worse. And now that may seem like a litany, and it is, and it should be terrifying. But we have data that also supports that this is a big change in the way that religious freedom has been operated. So before the courts were packed by Trump and Leonard Leo, the courts ruled in favor of religion about half the time. But under Roberts, one study found that win rate jumps up to 81%. And this is not just a pro-religion shift, this is a pro-Christian shift. So in the earlier courts, mainstream Christianity was favored in 44% of cases. Under Roberts, that doubles up to 85% of cases. And that doesn't include some of the biggest wins that I just mentioned at the very end there, those most recent terms. So what that tells us, when you look at that list and when you look at those numbers, it tells us that religious freedom has become a weapon of Christian privilege.
I am terrified by that litany when you pull it all together. But on the other side, what do you say to critics who argue that efforts to maintain church-state separation actually infringe on religious freedom?
That is, I think, one of the things that I try to identify in the three lines. Again, I don't think those questions are all that hard. So the short version of what are these three simple lines would be, first, we distinguish between action and belief. And the law has always done that. And the right to believe is absolute. The right to act on that belief is not. So I opened the book, American Crusade, with several stories about drivers letting Jesus take the wheel. Right? You know, actually letting go of their car steering wheel and doing so because they thought Jesus was going to guide the car. They are free to believe that Jesus is telling them, being a backseat driver, whatever it is. They're free to believe that, of course. But if they act on it, the civil law can step in and say no. It can fine them. It could take away their license, maybe send them to prison, depending on the outcome. Right? And nobody really disputes this. And none of the big groups that are coming to help weaponize religious freedom are coming to the aid of any of these drivers, right? Belief is unlimited. Action is limited. There's actually a sort of more extreme example that both the Supreme Court and Thomas Jefferson used to explain this distinction between action and belief was human sacrifice. Both Jefferson and the Supreme Court point out, like, it's okay to believe that, you know, you want, that God is saying you have to sacrifice a person, but you can't act on it. And if you do act on it, the state can come in and say, no, absolutely not. So belief is unlimited, action is limited. And so then that raises a question that the second line answers, which is, okay, if it's okay for the government to limit action, when is it permissible for the government to step in? And the answer here is also pretty simple. It's where the rights of other people begin. And we've all heard the old idiom that your right to swing your fist ends at the other person's nose. Well, your right to swing your religion, to exercise your religion, ends where the rights of other people begin. Which tells us, and this is a truism, that religion is not a license to harm others or infringe their rights in any way. And that rule answers a lot of the questions that have come before the court. And that's what I'm talking about when I'm saying the court is weaponizing religious freedom. They are abrogating that rule, destroying it, and saying, no, religious freedom is a license to harm other people and to violate their rights, which is inherently unequal, by the way. And then the third line is, I think, also pretty simple, and it's that line between church and state. And the simple fact is that our government has no religion to exercise. And I think another tweak that is helpful for people thinking about this is government officials cannot abuse the power of a government office, whether that is a coach at a public school or a teacher at a public school, all the way up to the president, and use those resources to promote their personal religion. And so when you have those basic lines established, the questions that are posed in these cases, they honestly become pretty easy to answer.
This is Law and Disorder, and today we're joined by guest Andrew Seidel, talking about separation of church and state. Andrew, tell us about this increasing presence of religious symbols in public spaces and government institutions and the effect that that can have on citizens.
Well, we are seeing a push to use the machinery of the state to impose religion on other people's kids, on American children. And this is kind of a wave of Christian nationalism that we've been seeing sweep across the country. You know, one prime example that really broke through in the national conversation was the Louisiana law requiring every public school classroom to display a state-sanctioned, state-mandated version of the Ten Commandments, which begins, "I am the Lord your God, you shall have no other God before me." So this is a prime example of how Christian nationalism is on the march across the country. And this is a law that forces public school children of all religion and of none to read and venerate the state's preferred brand of Christianity. This is just an abject violation of the separation of church and state and America's promise of religious freedom, right? Because you now have the state telling students which God to worship, how to worship that God, and using their power and the fact that students are required to attend public schools to confront them with this, in the state's eyes, truth. And so this is why Americans United for Separation of Church and State and our allies actually sued. I mean, Americans United for Separation of Church and State was created for moments like this. We were ready for this. We've been watching this law very closely. We were created to be that watchdog, to bring together non-religious and religious Americans for this very fight. And so we sued over that law with our allies. I mean, we're talking about school kids here, right? We are talking about a captive audience of kids going all the way down to kindergarten and below. They are young, they are impressionable. And no student should have to feel like they belong less than others because of their religious beliefs. And we represent some really brave parents. We actually have a number of clergy who are also plaintiffs in that lawsuit challenging this. And again, this is just one example of what we are seeing around the country. We've seen in Oklahoma, that state has tried to establish the nation's first religious public school. It's actually a virtual charter school, but it's still effectively the nation's first religious public school. Americans United and our allies sued over that. And actually, the state attorney general also sued over that and just had a victory there. But we've seen the state superintendent, Ryan Walters, announce that he's now going to force every teacher in the state of Oklahoma to teach from the Bible in their classroom. We still don't know what that means and are awaiting guidance, but we're, of course, watching that very closely and are willing to step in there as well, if need be. We saw Texas politicians talk about putting the Ten Commandments in their schools. We are also seeing Texas and Florida and several other states look at or adopt or consider adopting putting chaplains into the public schools, at times in place of certified, trained counselors. So this is a trend going on around the country, and Americans United for Separation of Church and State is on the front lines fighting back against this Christian nationalism.
This can get abstract for people, and I want to think about it in terms of the real families and the children that you've been talking about. What kind of advice do you have for those families who are subjected to unwanted religious teachings and religious iconography in public schools?
Contact Americans United at AU.org. We have a place where people can report those kind of constitutional violations, and our lawyers step in and work to help them. We also publish every year a set of Know Your Rights guides for families and for teachers in the public schools. We have a lot of great allies who are teachers in the public schools who don't want their classrooms to be politicized, who don't want to have to teach the Bible, who don't want to see the Ten Commandments, which begin, "I am the Lord your God, you shall have no other gods before me," on their classroom walls. The second thing is that if you are able to fight back against these, you should. And whether that means attending, you know, your local school board of education meeting, or as we, you know, some of the brave plaintiffs in our Ten Commandments lawsuit are doing, joining up and fighting back for those who can't fight for themselves.
Andrew, as we close, what's your prediction? What's your vision for the future of religious freedom and secularism in the United States?
People like our brave plaintiffs, that in part give me hope. But I have even more hope because their power-hungry aggression is growing our movements. Their wins swell our ranks. But the whole reason we're seeing this rise of white Christian nationalism right now is because they are working to privilege the chosen few. But by definition, that means every time they win, they are alienating more people. They are waking more people up to the danger. They are driving more people away from their ideology. Their power-hungry aggression is growing our movement. And that means that in the end, we are going to win. They're crusading because we are working to meet those unmet promises that are in the U.S. Constitution, the simple idea that we the people means everyone. And as we continue to march toward that progress, they are fighting harder against it. They're not going to go gently. They're going to rage against the dying of their privilege. But in the end, we will win because they fight only for themselves. And where they are selfish, we can be selfless. They want supremacy. We want equality. So in the end, we're going to win, not because our principle is inherently better than theirs, even though it definitely is, but because the math is on our side. We have the numbers, and that's what they're fighting. That's what they're raging against. And they can rage all they want, but they can't really fight math. And so I have a lot of hope.
Well, you give us hope with the work you do every day, Andrew. Thank you for being with us. How can the audience follow your work?
I'm Andrew L. Seidel everywhere. Please go get American Crusade and the Founding Myth from your local library. And please follow Americans United for Separation of Church and State. We depend on the generosity and support of everyday people just like yourselves. Visit us at au.org.
Thank you, Andrew. Keep up the good work.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
Hamas's brutal attack on Israel on October 7 and Israel's deadly and sustained military assault on Gaza have had significant consequences in the United States, affecting the presidential election and triggering protests and counter-protests at hundreds of college campuses across the country. It's also presented a serious test for progressive Jews and progressive Jewish organizations in the United States. One of those organizations is Bend the Arc, which describes itself as, quote, building a multiracial, multiethnic, intergenerational movement of Jews and allies all across the country who are rising up to build an American future free of white supremacy, anti-Semitism, and racism. The Bend the Arc family of organizations includes a C3, C4, and a PAC. And in the past, I served as national chair of Bend the Arc C3 board, and I'm currently active in its work in the Southern California chapter, the statewide chapter. Until now, Bend the Arc had a strong boundary around working only on domestic, economic, and racial justice issues. But that all changed on June 4. On that day, Jamie Barron, CEO of Bend the Arc, sent a letter to President Biden. The letter welcomed Biden's support for a permanent ceasefire plan in Gaza, but quickly added that, quote, time and time again, despite your calls to end this violence, you have not followed through with material action. With over 1 million Palestinian refugees now facing being forced to flee Rafah, their last guaranteed refuge, thousands of lives lost, and families of captives being fined in Israel for demanding a ceasefire, it is long past time to end U.S. support for these attacks. Now is the moment to make good on your promise to stop providing offensive weapons to the Israeli military. To shed some light on how this progressive Jewish organization has navigated the changing political terrain after October 7, we've invited Jamie Barron to join us today. In her close to 20 years as a leader in the Jewish social justice space, Jamie has built justice organizations that embody their values inside and out. She's held many roles at Bend the Arc in her 15-year tenure, including 9 years of executive leadership, most recently as chief operating officer prior to becoming CEO. Before joining Bend the Arc, Jamie was the leadership development director at Habonim Dor North America. Jamie holds a BA from Goucher College and is an alumna of the UJA Federations and Columbia's Business School Institute for Jewish Executive Leadership. Jamie, it's a personal pleasure to welcome you to Law and Disorder.
Thank you so much, Steve. I'm so thrilled to be here with you today.
Jamie, to set the stage, tell us more about the origin and the mission and the activities of Bend the Arc, and why until now the organization had an ironclad policy that placed Israel-Palestine off limits.
Yeah, thank you, Steve. So as you referenced in the introduction, Bend the Arc is an organization that is building a movement of Jews and allies across the United States to fight for a future free from anti-Semitism, white supremacy, and racism, and for a country that ensures freedom and safety for all of us, no matter our religion, our race, or our background. And, you know, to that end, when Bend the Arc was established in 2011, we really set out to reverse the false notion that Jewish people only care about and only vote on issues of Israel-Palestine. We were aiming to organize the Jewish community around their stated commitment to progressive values that were grounded in the Jewish imperative to pursue justice. So in practice, that's really meant everything from welcoming people who are immigrants to upholding the right to vote to fighting for racial justice. And we've built a vibrant family of organizations, counting Bend the Arc, a Jewish Partnership for Justice, Bend the Arc Jewish Action, and our Bend the Arc Jewish Action PAC, where we have organized at the ballot box, in the halls of Congress, in Jewish communities, and in solidarity with allied groups. And today we're proud to have 13 active chapters across the country, including our California chapter that you referenced. And so to do this work effectively, we really needed to build the biggest base possible around a shared set of values from kind of a coalition stance, really. And in practice, that meant organizing groups and people who came into the organization with a wide range of perspectives around Israel-Palestine, even as they were aligned on our core values of fighting discrimination, oppression, and injustice here in the United States. And while it was possible, as you said, to maintain that kind of iron wall or steel door that kept Israel and Palestine off limits, that separation has been increasingly tested in recent years, as the conflict has become more inextricable from the domestic politics we work on here in the U.S. So for us, that has meant contending with questions, for example, about how to show up for progressive electeds who are champions of our domestic agenda, but whose criticism of Israel has resulted in them getting smeared as anti-Semitic. The conflict has come home, so to speak, and we knew that we'd have to address the tension at some point, and October 7th really accelerated that need.
So obviously, the letter to Biden broke through that wall within the organization. Tell me what prompted Bend the Arc to take the public stance on Palestine-Israel for the first time, and what are you urging President Biden to do?
Yeah, so like many organizations since October 7th, we've had to wrestle with our orientation to the violence in Israel and Palestine and navigate significant divisions within our membership as a Jewish organization. And at the same time, it really became untenable to move our domestic agenda in a vacuum from the impact of that violence, whether that was around conducting trainings on dismantling anti-Semitism, supporting progressive electeds, as I referenced a few minutes ago, or talking about what the path is to collective safety and liberation. And, you know, in the end, we really see this letter as a continuation of our commitment to pursue justice and equity here in the U.S. The scale and duration of the sustained assault in Gaza and the devastating human toll it has taken made it a moral imperative for us to speak out. And the conflict has also empowered extremist right-wing elements, both in Israel and here in the United States. It's unleashed an alarming crackdown on civil liberties and freedom of speech, and we really just could no longer stay silent on all of that, and especially given all of it was happening in the name of Jewish safety. And so our letter to President Biden urged him to make good on his own promise to stop sending offensive weapons to Israel, to end the violence and to do his part to end the violence, and to reach a resolution that brings all captives home, including Israeli hostages and Palestinian prisoners. And the stakes for us in this moment are really clear. You know, in addition to the lives and safety of Palestinian and Israeli people in the region and their future ability to live in freedom and safety alongside each other, the violence is threatening a future where all of us can live in freedom, safety, and dignity here in the U.S. as well. And so that was why we really felt like we had to speak out.
Your letter continues and elaborates on the repercussions in the United States from what's happening in Israel and Gaza. How do you see that playing out?
Yeah, I mean, that was really a primary motivation for us to write the letter at the time when we did, as we were watching these domestic dynamics continue to escalate. You know, history has shown us in many, many instances that explosions of global violence tend to dramatically increase violence here at home. And in the past 8 months, anti-Semitism has surged, as well as anti-Muslim and anti-Arab bigotry and racism. And leaders have scrambled, as they so often do, for carceral solutions, you know, solutions that involve increased policing and increased, you know, guns, guards, and gates, as well as attacks on our civil liberties to create a false sense of safety. And often using the safety of Jewish people as the reason for those shifts and for those increases in carceral solutions. So some examples of that that we've seen are leaders across the country deploying militarized police to attack protesters and introducing national and local gag laws to curtail free speech in the guise of fighting anti-Semitism. Billionaire GOP donors, again under the guise of being pro-Israel, have tried to influence elections against those who are fighting to expand and protect our democracy, including within Democratic Party primaries. And Republicans are already openly organizing to destroy our democracy, as stated both in the recently released GOP platform and in Project 2025, which is something we've been paying close attention to for a while and is starting to get more public visibility. These projects give Trump authoritarian powers in the interest of a minority rule. And we were seeing the ways that the conflict was more and more embroiled in the U.S. election. So we can't let this ongoing conflict continue to fracture the Democratic coalition in this critical moment and pave the way to a Trump victory. If we do that, we are all going to lose, including Palestinians and Israelis.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. Unlike a lot of Jewish organizations, you mentioned this earlier, there's a wide variety of politics in the Bend the Arc base that it must be hard to hold at any time, and not to mention at a time of huge division in the Jewish community itself. Has this been difficult for Bend the Arc?
When it comes to Palestine and Israel, the challenges that we, because of our hard line that we had in the past, we actually didn't know where a lot of our membership stood. And so as we were having our internal discussions about making these shifts and kind of gearing up to speak out on what was happening more explicitly, we decided to launch a survey back in March to really understand the views of our base a little bit better, of our membership. And so we asked them about their views on domestic issues, on elected officials, on their views on anti-Semitism, and if those have changed in the past, at the time, 6 months, as well as direct questions about the violence in Gaza and Israel. And we were actually pleasantly surprised to learn that 85% of respondents to our survey stated that they supported a bilateral ceasefire back in March. And that was one of the reasons that actually also motivated our letter to President Biden, because we believed that we had the support of the majority of our people to take a step like this. And that hasn't been true across all Jewish communities, as you, I'm sure, well know. And that survey was also a starting point, not the end. You know, tensions continue to exist, especially as the facts continue to change on the ground. And we've chosen to lean into conversation and discussion rather than exclusion and division. In a fight for democracy and justice, we know we need to preserve and build our relationships for the long term, and that our coalitions are what are going to get us through this time. And so while there is political diversity among American Jews, there has been a strong history of alignment in terms of voting patterns and public support for a range of domestic issues. And the right is taking advantage of this moment to widen cracks in that alignment.
So you've mentioned anti-Semitism several times, of course. What would you say to critics who say that criticizing Israel is a form of anti-Semitism? How does Bend the Arc address anti-Semitism, and what's the organization doing to fight it?
Yeah, I mean, I have a lot to say on that, Steve. I will start with saying that anti-Semitism is a real threat to the safety of Jewish people, and we need to take it seriously. Many Jewish people are experiencing more anti-Semitism and, as a result, more fear than many of us have in recent memory, particularly in this country. Anti-Semitism is also a threat to all people. It's part of the machinery of division and fear that politicians and white nationalists use to rely on and consolidate their power. It's the same machinery that those politicians use to blame black and brown people, people who are immigrants, people who are Arab and Muslim, and more, to sow fear and division. And the answer to this question is also nuanced. And, you know, there's been so much public conversation and debate over what anti-Semitism is, kind of what counts as anti-Semitism. And I want to say explicitly that criticism of Israel's policies or government is not anti-Semitic. And particularly in this moment, when Israel is waging an incredibly destructive siege in Gaza that seems to have no end in sight, it is critical to protect people's right to protest and speak out about those actions. By the way, including Jewish people's right to speak out and protest about those actions. It's also important for American Jews to recognize that not everything that makes us uncomfortable, scared, or even perspectives that some may really disagree with is anti-Semitic. Efforts to undermine criticism under the guise of calling anti-Semitism are often disingenuous, and they stoke fear and don't help make anyone safer. And it's also important to be specific in that criticism. Conflating the actions of Israel with all Jews, for example, or holding individual Jewish people responsible for the actions of a state, I believe is anti-Semitic. And our movements, our progressive movements, our social movements are reflections of our society. So of course we see anti-Semitism and racism, misogyny, and all other forms of oppression arrive within movement spaces. And we have to address those things when they arise. You know, all of these forms of oppression and bigotry are in our society. They're messages we hear all around us. And so we take them in. And in doing so, it's also important to distinguish between using and fueling anti-Semitism. Those who use anti-Semitism do it intentionally to serve their political or personal aims, but anti-Semitism can also be fueled, sometimes unintentionally, like someone using an anti-Semitic trope unknowingly and being willing to learn something about that and change their message the next time. We've also seen how anti-Semitism has been cynically exploited by the right, who use anti-Semitism to undermine our democracy and pit Americans against each other. That is something that started well before October 7th and something that Bend the Arc has been contesting with for a long time. The right is using anti-Semitism as a smokescreen to pursue their undemocratic agenda. And examples of that are attacks on higher education and the right to protest, undermining Black and Brown progressive electeds through often false or exaggerated accusations of anti-Semitism, or introducing gag legislation to codify a definition of anti-Semitism that would only further embolden this agenda. And so it's really vital, more now than ever, that we define our terms when we talk about anti-Semitism. That's why we have endeavored to provide resources that can help people identify, talk about, and address anti-Semitism in ways that can actually end it. For example, through our anti-Semitism messaging guide and training series. The resource underscores that we need to treat anti-Semitism not as an eternal, never-ending threat, like so much of the kind of conventional wisdom does. We talk about anti-Semitism like it's a virus, like it's in the water. And this implies that it's both not human-made and humans can't do anything about it. But really, anti-Semitism is a tool of our oppressors that is used to divide us and keep us from working together and building power to win the things that we all need to thrive.
Well, you did have a lot to say on that, and all of it is so important. This is Law and Disorder, and today we're talking with Jamie Baron, the CEO of Bend the Arc. As I know from my time in leadership at Bend the Arc, it's often inside the White House, inside legislative offices, grappling with anti-Semitism, Jewish safety, and all of its issues. Does making such a public demand on President Biden risk your access to that kind of inside influence?
Our role isn't to secure the greatest amount of access within the halls of power. It's to challenge those in power to work on behalf of the members that we serve and the issues and values that we stand for. And in this moment, that can often mean challenging leaders to understand that Jewish safety does not mean unconditional support for the Israeli government. And we're proud to stand behind that. You know, Bend the Arc has always been built on having both an inside and outside strategy. You know, we've had times on individual days where we've been protesting in the Capitol while lobbying inside the same building, to ask our senators to change policies. And that has really given us credibility built over many years in the halls of power, while also being ready and willing to push our leaders to stand on the values they espouse. And I've really been proud to be, you know, often the most progressive Jewish leader in the room in conversations with the administration about these very issues, and particularly around these questions of how to most effectively fight anti-Semitism. And by the way, this hasn't been our only disagreement with President Biden. You know, we've differed from the president and other elected officials that we support on a number of issues. For example, just a few weeks ago, we came out pretty strong against Biden's increasingly right turn on immigration. And we know that our relationship with the White House is strong. And like any strong relationship, it's able to withstand disagreement. And it's important for Biden to understand that he has a progressive base, including a progressive Jewish base, and he needs to be accountable to us.
I've always been impressed by Bend the Arc's inside-outside strategy. I remember a period when a representative of Bend the Arc was in the White House accepting a pen for President Obama signing legislation, while Bend the Arc was outside the White House protesting his deportation policy. But let me ask you, Bend the Arc has appeared to go outside those bounds, not just with Biden, but with other Jewish institutions. There was a recent controversy over Jonathan Greenblatt at the Anti-Defamation League. Tell us about that and how it connected to Bend the Arc's principles and your work.
Yeah, so first I'll just say that, you know, we work with many Jewish organizations, at different parts of the political spectrum. And there are many Jewish institutions that are claiming to stand for the whole of the Jewish community right now that actually don't, because we know that many individual American Jews really do agree with us on the positions that we've taken in recent months. And many in the Jewish community also look to the ADL as an expert. And there are many people on their staff who are experts and who really care about fighting anti-Semitism and ending it. And pushing back against a peer organization publicly is not something that we take lightly. But we've also seen their leadership support and work closely, sort of bafflingly, with openly anti-Semitic individuals like Elon Musk. And we're really worried about any use of anti-Semitism, real or exaggerated, to power an agenda that is antithetical to the long-term security of the Jewish people. So in this instance that you're referencing, Jonathan Greenblatt accused campus protesters back in April of being proxies for Iran, among other slurs. And we knew that there were Jewish students in the encampments as well as outside of them. And, you know, we really felt that Greenblatt's claim to care about Jewish safety while demonizing students, the majority of whom we really believe were protesting in good faith for the safety of Gazans, despite some individual anti-Semitic incidents, you know, really fanned the flames of Jewish fear and ultimately undermined free speech and democracy. Over the past, you know, many months since October 7th, I've had so many conversations with our supporters and our donors who have shared that they're having really complex conversations within their own families, you know, grappling with these questions around Israel-Palestine, and, you know, in many cases, disagreeing with their adult children who are vehemently against Israel's actions in Gaza. And, you know, I kept thinking about those conversations, as well as the photos of Jewish students who were holding Passover Seders in the encampments, and about how those same students, along with their non-Jewish peers, were being wholesale demonized as anti-Semitic and corrupted by foreign influences. And that stance also empowered the right and undermined their freedom of speech and endangered the safety of the protesters by calling on a militarized police presence to break up the protests. And, you know, I really felt that it was putting students, and particularly Black, Brown, queer, and disabled students, in real danger. And so we just felt like we could not stand by and allow that rhetoric to go unchecked. And so we put out, you know, a public call, you know, asking him to kind of rescind those statements because, you know, they just felt like they were dangerous and problematic.
Jamie, what's been the response either from the White House or publicly to your letter in June, as well as your statement regarding the ADL?
Yeah, so we didn't hear back directly from the White House on the statement, but we weren't particularly expecting to. But the public response, and response particularly from, you know, our progressive partners and allies, has been really positive. There was a very interesting thing that happened that the same week that we put our letter out, the NAACP released a letter with actually a very similar framing to ours. And actually the families of the Israeli hostages, and a group of them, came out asking for Jewish organizations in the U.S. to call for a ceasefire and really making a statement that the continued violence in Gaza was not the path to actually bringing home their family members, bringing home the hostages. And so it felt really powerful to be kind of among that esteemed company in making this statement that we did. And we saw a number of partners and folks on social media kind of holding those things together as a sign of, you know, another kind of tipping point moment in this long and ongoing conflict. And so we were really proud of having that impact. And within our own base, in general, we've gotten a lot of support. Of course, there has been some mixed responses and some criticism. But, you know, it's one of those times where if you're saying or doing something that makes everybody happy, you're probably not actually taking the moral stance that you need to take. So I stand behind everything that we did and feel really proud of this work.
Jamie, I really want to thank you for coming on today and joining us on Law and Disorder. And more broadly, I want to thank you for the work you do, waking up every morning, confronting these issues with conscience and a sense of justice. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Stephen. Thank you for all the work that you do, for your longtime leadership in Bend the Arc, and for inviting me to join you today. I'm really, really honored to be part of this conversation with you.
Thank you, Jamie.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.